The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I thank you for joining me this July 11th installment of the Heretics Hour. I have a very special guest on the phone from Australia. Yes, it's Frederick Tobin. Who else would it be? His name is synonymous with Adelaide, Australia. His long-running website is www.adelaideinstitute.org. That's spelled A-D-E-L-A-I-D-E. And he brings you there all the revisionist news. He's got some new things posted I just saw. And also, very important, his monthly newsletter, which is quite well done. So are you connected, Frederick?
Yes, I am, Caroline. And hello and welcome.
Well, welcome.
Today is, of course, Today, of course, is the 12th in Australia. We're just on 5 minutes past 11 a.m.
I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot. That's important to mention. You know, we're really on opposite sides of the world, aren't we?
Yes, and usually America, we're usually, before the internet, we were about months behind American impulses of innovation and so on. And now with the internet, we're just a few minutes behind. But the interesting thing is that America will never catch up to Australia. We're always ahead.
That's right. You are really ahead. When I think that, you know, you're on the next day, it's quite interesting. Well, now it's a very hot summer here, and you're having your winter now, I guess, right?
Indeed. The nights are cold. We do have sunny days. The southern Australian landscape is being hit by cold days and nights and rain. In other words, it's winter. Further north, of course, towards the middle, and then further up the top, Darwin. This is where we have tropical Australia, equivalent to the weather in Southeast Asia. So Australia has the whole span, very similar to you. If you go south to Florida, this is us going north to Darwin.
I know. It's so interesting to try to remember that when down under, when you're going south, you're getting colder. And when you're going
indeed.
North, you're getting warmer. Yeah.
Yes, well, And the sun at noon is in the north, while in the northern hemisphere, the sun at noontime is in the south.
Yes. Well, I have never been there. I have never been south of the equator. So I don't suppose I'll ever get there now. But, well, you never know.
Yeah.
But now, get up here. You travel around quite a bit. And I do want to mention that we met here in Texas last summer. Or was it fall?
Indeed.
Because here it's hard to tell whether I remember if it's summer or fall. But actually, last week I said on another program that we had met in 2009. And I can't, then I thought, that's not right. And I checked it out. But it certainly seems longer than 1 year ago.
Yes. And it was fall, of course, is our autumn.
Yes. But when it was last summer that we met, that you were here in
Austin, I think it was 2010, because 2009 I was in prison.
That's what I mean. It was last year, 2010.
It was last year, 2010, yes.
Yeah,
With James Damon.
Yes, yes. And we spent 2 days visiting together. And I probably had more time with you than anyone else there, maybe except for James and his wife later. But I remember I was making the most of every moment, and I was really plaguing you with questions and trying to get everything you knew out of you.
Yeah, and, well, sometimes, you know, you just wonder whether through the internet the answers are there. If you Google anything, you'll find some kind of answer. But all too often, that's an electronic media, and it is much nicer if, and this is where we get back to having conferences and so on, where the people interact, where you can then, in many instances, get information that is perhaps in the subconscious that's not there immediately, and then you suddenly realize these people have been thinking about certain things for a lifetime, and suddenly it dawns on them. Because all this process of trying to make sense of the world, of developing a worldview within your own mind, is a long maturing process, and it certainly doesn't happen if educators talk about you have to change. People don't change at all, because we do develop. And I have developed, if I may say so, by the force of law being applied to me. I'm not the director of Adelaide Institute anymore. For 2 years now, Mr. Peter Hartung of Adelaide, born and bred in Adelaide, Peter is now in charge of Adelaide Institute. Because I am not, I've been too busy fending off this whole business of being taken to court and taken the crime was contempt of court, but in fact it dealt with matters Holocaust.
Yes, all right. Well, you know, you have been in trouble a lot. You're always in trouble. You're always getting in trouble. They give you trouble. And so
But let me just say, if you say trouble, you're emphasizing it.
I'm saying it as a joke, kind of.
Yeah, I know. But Caroline, life is trouble. Only death is not.
Yes.
And as Zora said, to be alive is to take off your belt and look for trouble. But I haven't really looked for trouble as such, except that as a human being, I have always asked questions. And I noticed the older I got, the more difficult it was to get answers on certain issues. For example, I was thinking recently when Helen Thomas... for how many years was she in the White House, a reporter? 50-odd years.
Mm-hmm.
And for once, she was asked by a rabbi with his camcorder what would be the solution for Israel. And she said, send them home. And he said, what? And she said, yeah, send them home to Germany and Poland. And then, of course, an apology followed, and then she resigned. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if a woman of 80 or 90 or any person reaches that age and then after 50 years of being sort of a good boy or good girl, and then finally in high old age dares to ask pressing questions, I think that's moral cowardice. We should be asking. As an educator, I always said to my students, they must ask questions. I don't want to know what they're what they're feeling, how they feel, and so on. No, ask questions. And if people say, for example, again, going back to it's an autobiographical thing. I was in primary school, and I used to ask questions, and a teacher said to me, you're rude. I said, why? And she said, because you asked too many questions.
Well, Frederick, I'm famous for being rude, so maybe you're giving me a nice boost here.
Well, it's not a rudeness. It's merely an asking of questions, because without information, without having this store or this drawing on a vast source of information, we cannot function properly. And if we all know that everything is censored for good or ill, or for good intention, bad intention, whatever. But if we are censored in asking questions, this is why I say that in a democracy, if we can't ask questions, then we haven't got a democracy anymore. And I think of this Ray McGovern business. You know, I only came across this last week because Gordon Duff had it on his website that in February, I think it was 15th or so, that McGovern merely stood up at Hillary Clinton's speech talking about some freedom and democracy in America and not this being the case in the Middle East or in Iran and so on. And what have you got? He merely stands up because he's got a T-shirt with some writing on it. He gets pounced on and carted off. But remember that he was a CIA operative for decades. Now, we've got this same situation now where these operatives who are holding up the government, they should speak up. They should open up much, much earlier. Instead, what you have, remember Anthony Lawson's video clip showing how when Netanyahu addressed the Congress and 29 times they rise in unison. That is frightening.
Well, Frederick, you know, this is, we know that there's nothing behind all this. So I don't know why, I don't expect anything from these people. I don't even want their democracy. Do you?
No, but I still say they're influencing individuals and we should have the right to oppose. And that's why your program is so wonderful.
Well, sure. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, let's get back to the trouble that they give you. Now, your latest bout with Australian justice and Australian Jews, and I have to say that because they're the ones who are after you. What were they after with you? And what were they so unhappy about?
It's essentially, it happened in 96 when the Simon Wiesenthal Center of Los Angeles, rabbi here, whom I met afterwards, he indicated per a newspaper article that there was an anti-Semitic website, Adelaide Institute. We'd been going for 2 years as an institute, and then on the 1st of May we started 96 with the website. And he indicated there was a racist website. The Brisbane Courier Mail picked it up, and then immediately the complaint was made by the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. And you've got to remember, these are all groups, Jewry, the Anti-Defamation League and so on. It's all individuals. They have grand-sounding names, but it's only two or three individuals behind the scene who actually push it. And
we make too much about this Jewish power.
I think so. I always said that one of my maxims is, you know, don't blame the Jews, blame those that bend to their pressure. So if you have the American Congress rising 29 times for some mundane comments that the Israeli Prime Minister makes, then it reflects on them, not on the power the Prime Minister has over the Congress. That's the point.
That's right.
And people have to rethink this. It's so comfortable to blame the Jews for everything or to find a scapegoat. It's essentially a scapegoat mentality where you blame others for your own mental laziness. And you want to stay in your comfort zone, so you swim with the stream. You know, the dead fish swim with the stream and not those who are thinking.
Agreed. I do agree with that.
We have an agreement. Oh, look, I think that's excellent, isn't it? We have an agreement. We're not squabbling as we were a couple of years ago.
Last year. We didn't squabble all that much, but now and then.
No, it's not a squabbling either. You see, I always see this as clarification. We're clarifying. If we do not confront, if we avoid confrontation, how can we clarify our own confusion?
Absolutely. I'm all for confrontation. And too many people avoid it like the plague. Now, how about they wanted you to pay this big fine, court costs, and some kind of a fine that they, when you lost to them in court some time back. And I guess that was never paid. And now your latest case was that they wanted to fine you extra for not paying that. And you said, well, I'm going to pay it now. Is that right?
Yeah, not quite. The actual court costs, they initially wanted over 100 something. Before that, it was 250,000. So right. That's been whittled down by the taxing master.
Right.
In the court system, they have the specialists who weed out padding, legal fees, and so on. What transpired was that the action against me was done pro bono, and therefore there are certain fees that they could not claim. And this was therefore reduced to 56,000 plus and 72 or 74 cents. What's interesting is the total sum came to $60,066 or something. In other words, the sixes are there. And for the mystics,
right.
And for the superstitious, this is all the good stuff. But what they did, I essentially opposed the taxing because I didn't get notification, proper notification of all this. Mm-hmm. And so I rejected the demands. And I did have a firm engaged in Melbourne, but they had an individual who didn't look after my case. The person left the firm, and then it was dormant. And so when the actual 21 days of response time ran out, I found out that my matter had not been looked at. And so I was 2 days out of time. And the judge
yes.
had to look at that. And the judge, luckily, could see that there were irregularities because the bankruptcy proceedings, it was the second one. The first one they withdrew or I had dismissed through a registrar. And so they had a second go, and the second one was done properly. But then I was out of time, and so the whole thing went on. And ultimately, we paid, and that's it. But $60,000, where do you find that? And that's very, very difficult. Nowadays, the revisionist movement as such hasn't got the financial clout that it used to. It's not that interesting for certain individuals anymore. Therefore, we have to battle to make this whole business continue to function. And that's where I praise the Barnes Review, Willis Carter and Elizabeth Carter and Paul Angel and Petherick and, well, all those at AFP and the Barnes Review who are continuing the
yes.
actual revisionist fight in a broad, broad sense. And this was the idea, if I may just digress slightly, mm-hmm. that, for example, the IHR, had things gone according to plan, we would have had a functioning tertiary institution granting degrees and so on in a regular way with the revisionist topic. But in 93, because of financial wranglings or because there was an inheritance, and individuals who never had any money themselves saw an opportunity to enrich themselves, and they made a grab for it. And, of course, the court system, which they initially hated and didn't like because they didn't see it as fair this time, the court and what they were doing to destroy Liberty Lobby and Spotlight and so on, that was all then considered fair game. And as I said, had the thing worked out, then we would have been in a much, much stronger position. At the moment, therefore, we're still on the sideline. But what's helping the revisionists now is the climate change debate that's whirling around the world. And because even in Australia just recently, or a few days ago, Lord Monckton, who opposes this whole climate change push, he's called a climate change denier, and the University of Western Australia cancelled one of his lectures, the venue. In Adelaide, it was cancelled. In Sydney, he had to go to the park. It was a lovely sunny day a few days ago, so it was good. But we have this problem where individuals are now called climate change deniers. And the next move is Holocaust denier. So, well, that's where we are. And this is assisting individuals who dared to question the foundation of the Holocaust. For example, the three pillars, that there were 6 million who were killed. It was a systematic extermination process. And number three, in homicidal gas chambers. Now, anyone who disagrees with these or asks questions about it is immediately called a Holocaust denier. And that is the, as you well know, the stopper for a further asking of questions.
And, well, you know, I really don't think it should be, because I think it's time that we just accept being Holocaust deniers. I do. I'm not worried about that phrase. What do you think about, what do you think about the word denier, and what do you think about the word Holocaust, too? Because I'm also saying we shouldn't even be using the word Holocaust, because it's not properly descriptive of what happened.
Yeah, indeed. This is the problem. But denier, I always say, how can I be called a denier? How can I deny that which never happened? But, of course, then I'm committing a crime in Germany and elsewhere.
Then you're more of a denier.
Well, indeed,
yes. You're a denier then.
And this is where the Bishop Williamson case is interesting, because the judgment's just come out, the appeal. They're going through appeal again. But, you know, the Catholic Church has backtracked tremendously, but they haven't stripped him totally of office. But he has had a reduced income, therefore from €10,000 fine to it was reduced to €6,000 because he has no means to pay. But the whole thing is absurd. And if you read what the commentary say, the David Martin Kurtz, he's the president of the Jewish community in Regensburg. He says it's a cheek. Or Frechheit, a cheek that historical events are questioned, because by doing that, you are defaming further the deceased. Now, in defamation, anyone who dies is not able to defend his reputation. And we should have that. There's only one item in the world that goes into death, and that is the Holocaust legislation, where defaming the dead is a crime, and this is just nonsense. But it opens up the other thing, and you'll notice whenever there's anything about Holocaust, the media whips up the Adolf Hitler thing again, and the National Socialist, and even I remember I just saw one item where when I looked at that other case with the what's his name, the McGovern thing, I think when that matter was carried through, they immediately said, you see, the Nazis, the National Socialists, and the American commentators are reasonably liberal. They always pull out the Hitler card.
Oh yes.
And I worry about.
You know, go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Go ahead. You said you worry about...
I worry when anyone who pulls out the Hitler card or the Nazi card has lost the argument, because we're bumping against a situation that prevailed during the 1930s. Robert Wistich, the professor of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, he made a comment about anti-Semitism being on the rise in Britain and so on. What's not... then raised is, why is there this anti-Jewish element? And all too often it is merely the behavior of Jewish individuals and corporations, and, well, very often they're multinationals, multinational cartels and so on. They are actually generating forms of behavior that others object to.
Well, sure they are. Sure they are. And most people don't have the nerve to say that. They don't want to say that, or they don't even believe it. But now, Williamson, I think the Williamson case is doing a lot of is very effective in bringing attention to this. There's something about him and the little thing that he said you know, and this is one of the few bits of revisionist revisionists that get into the headlines, that get into news, you know, that the news media will carry. And even that, I couldn't find anything in the German news media today about it, but it is, of course, the Jewish media carries it, and then there are some things in English language.
Yeah, no, I found them in the Bavarian newspaper in German.
Okay.
They've got them. Yeah,
okay.
Very
yeah.
interesting that they actually, they bring all these things, but then they say, you know, how terrible to be denying historical facts. Well, all historical facts, and I'm then reminded of President Ahmadinejad in Iran, how he said, is it not... well, can we not discuss any facts?
Well, we have to break for our news break. It wasn't watching time well enough. We'll be back in a few minutes, ladies.
Okay.
Gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
While NATO reports on the success of its bombing missions in Libya, some countries taking part in the campaign don't share that enthusiasm. Many in Spain say they've been dragged into the war under pressure from D.C. RT Sarah Firth reports from Madrid.
We appreciate Spain's contributions to enforcing the no-fly zone and the arms embargo. The NATO-led mission is on track.
A pat on the back for Spain. But not everyone feels quite so pleased with Spain's involvement in Libya, least of all the Spanish people.
The Spanish government support the Libya invasion with Spanish troops because the NATO requires that. The NATO order that. And the parliament and the government agrees, but not the public opinion.
Recent polls have shown a large majority of the population are now against the military campaign. And as Spain continues to sway on the abyss of economic crisis, political and public unrest has been growing.
It's been carried out in the conditions of a tough economic crisis, in conditions when the government had to sacrifice a lot and introduce huge reduction of costs in the social sphere. We think it's unfair that when there is a program of material aid reduction, the state participates in a conflict which will be damaging to the country's economy.
Yet the U.S. Defense Secretary has still called on Spain, among others, to play a more active role in the NATO mission. And despite the collapse of their housing market and with unemployment at critical level, Spain has indefinitely extended its mandate for involvement in Libya.
We don't think it's a humanitarian reason to go to Libya now, because we didn't care about human rights a year ago when we were selling Libya military equipment. Libyan people had rights a year ago and we didn't care about it.
Welcomed in Spain in recent years, Gaddafi was even awarded the keys to the city on an official visit to Madrid. The U-turn mirrors that of many Western countries, who until recently had courted Gaddafi and tolerated his regime.
We think that the operation against Libya is an action performed solely in the strategic interests of the major powers. Such an example of double standards of morals cannot be justified by the international community.
NATO members themselves have taken very different views about the action being taken in Libya, with less than half the countries even taking part. It's put pressure on parties.
Let's return to The Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm here with my very special guest, Frederick Tobin. And during the break, we were having a great conversation, which I would like to see if we might carry on a little bit on the air with the rest of you. We were talking about the fact that this huge Jewish menace is really, well, as Frederick said, smoke and mirrors. And if we were agreeing that if we just stand up to it, if enough people would stand up to it, they'd pretty much collapse and back down. What do you say about that, Frederick?
Well, Wilhelm Stekler, years ago in Germany, he's the judge who had a doctorate of law. And in 83, because he had written a book in 77, The Auschwitz Myth, he had his doctorate revoked by the University of Göttingen. And therefore, a signal was sent into academia that anyone who dared touch the topic of the Holocaust would also lose his academic qualifications. Now, that kind of thing, he said, if only 100 judges stood up to the law, then, in fact, the whole thing would break down. This hasn't happened because the ones who are imbued with this spirit of censorship, they are so refined, they know whom to knock off in socially, then financially, and then, of course, using legal means. And you find that there is a downside or another side to all this mechanism. I found this in Australia just the other week, where on the one hand we have tremendous freedom, yet we have the Jewish community highly stylized, highly socialized, focused on combating Holocaust, so-called Holocaust denial. And they then use legal mechanism to silence their enemy. And they've done that effectively with me, except I escaped bankruptcy and so I'm still there. But the downside is that we have this much freedom and democracy and smoke and mirrors and bread and circuses and all that, and yet last week in Sydney, a woman was discovered in a house. She had been dead for 8 years. Now, a few days later, a man was discovered in Perth in Western Australia in a house. He had been dead for 2 years. Now, this is a reflection of our society having a massive, massive problem. How can anyone disappear after a few days? Mm-hmm. And people don't know where they are.
Really?
This means there's a fundamental value shift or problem in our Western democratic lifestyle that we seem to gloss over through this frenzied business of going shopping. And I will say that the only thing we still have in our society, the only freedom we have is the freedom to go shopping.
Well, I hate shopping, and this is why I'm a nationalist. I think that the solution to this kind of thing is nationalism, where you're living among people who you care about because they're your own people, and you have a sense of a real community and nation.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Caroline, you've mentioned the concept that lies dear to my heart as well, and that is nationalism. We don't have left-wing or right-wing politics the way it's suggested in the media, left or right-wing. That's all nonsense.
Exactly.
What it is national versus international. And they need not be antagonistic to one another, to each other. But nationalism means from the family to the state to the nation. And if we don't have that, if we have internationals or a bureaucratic mindset controlling us, as the American philosopher Charles Saunders Peirce, on whom I wrote my thesis, he was the fallibilist, he said that if professors are well-to-do, our problem with knowledge is evident. If a bureaucracy is more knowledgeable than anybody else, the case is worse. And this is what's happening. We are being so over-bureaucratized that, for example, at the universities, we have ministries of foreign affairs where we bring in foreign students at the expense of the local students. We do all sorts of things where ethics committees already vet what can be thought about, what can be researched on. Now, that is anathema to a normal scientist who does not want to be controlled by anything except the idea of researching something. And it doesn't matter how it's done, but this is the problem. They say we must have an ethical framework, which is in essence a given, but the ethical frameworks given nowadays are limited by concepts such as race, ethnicity, and other blocking concepts that prevent us from digging deep into fundamentals.
Well,
and in America, I'm not sure, but I saw this on Google, and so I saw it on Google, so it must be true. Mm-hmm. But in America, they're now outsourcing the correcting of exam papers to the Philippines, to India, to Malaysia, and I think Singapore. I'd love to have someone inform me on this in more detail. Which university is doing this, or which universities, where everything nowadays is outsourced while the local community disintegrates?
Yes. Well, you've got some new articles on the website, which you don't run, but Peter runs. But one is that 1 in 4 primary school pupils are from an ethnic minority. This is in Britain. And almost 1 million school children do not speak English as their first language. And they go into this story. And this is what they are doing to us on purpose, to destroy our ability to think in terms as a nation. And therefore, we become we're not able to coalesce as a national group in our own national interests. They know that this is very strong, and they've tried to demonize it as being causing war and so on, being the cause of the wars of the 20th century, which is not true. But there was a lot of nationalism, but it didn't have to end up in major wars. But that was engineered. So now, you know, we're being multiculturalized to death, so that we cannot function as a strong group of ethnically similar people who have similar interests and can therefore organize into something strong. And so now we have revisionism, which is a lot of people from different countries who are working together on this. And how do you think that can be take the place of our nationalism?
The revisionists, you know, I simply see that as an heuristic principle. It's a sort of a method. I've always termed this when I hear revisionists, I simply think, well, if somebody's labeled a revisionist, he or she is a thinker. Mm-hmm. Anyone who thinks. And as I remember as a teacher, I used to write on the board, don't tell me how you feel today, tell me what you're thinking. Because feeling is subjective, and feeling goes into the bottomless pit. And if somebody lets themselves be disturbed by somebody else's whatever comes to them and say, oh, my feelings are hurt, that is the problem. And this is what I was sentenced under in the Racial Discrimination Act in Australia punishes those whose material is likely to offend, intimidate, and so on. And so, nowadays, you know, when you have young recruits in the army, and the sergeant major shouts at them, many of them burst into tears because they've never been smithied on the anvil of life. They've never been made tough, because yes. character development nowadays is shunned. It's seen as a discrimination. You cannot develop a strong character. For 7 days, I was in this punishment section at one of the prisons, Yatala in South Australia, and I was given the works. I was shouted at, abused, sworn at. It was really wonderful, because I knew from my basic training that what they tried to do was strengthen a prisoner's sense of worth, building them up, because most prisoners are broken down people who are on drugs and who see themselves as victims of life and so on, mm-hmm. instead of waking up to themselves and just growing up a bit.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. Well, now let's take a look at what's happening in Spain there. This was back last month in June, but there was a ruling by the Supreme Court that neo-Nazi literature and speech cannot be punishable as a crime. And this, there were four men who were on trial for selling literature. Two were running a bookstore, and the other two were writing or something. And they were found. They were let go. Now we have this Pedro Varela, who was also selling what they called neo-Nazi literature in Spain, and he was sentenced to a prison 2 years ago, last year, and he was given a sentence of, I think, 2 years. Now, what's going to happen to him? And do you think that this carries any weight, or is it just another one of those things that comes and goes?
I'm not sure. On the 3rd of June, when the judgment came through, I thought, goodness me, Spain is actually reverting back to its nationalist stance that had been broken down to the point where Geert Honzik, who had lived in Spain for 15 odd years and propagated the National Socialist material and celebrated Adolf Hitler
Having a little trouble with your phone. We're getting your voice is starting to break up a little bit.
Oh, goodness me. This is Avatar. Are you there?
Yeah, I can hear you, but it's getting kind of jumbled. Take your phone a little bit. I don't know. Okay.
It was sent extradited to Austria. That's the problem, that the legal framework had developed in negative ways in Spain, and he joined, of course, the Tremont Republic, who's still up. He's got about 6 years, and in Germany, Horst Mahler. But with this ruling on the 3rd of June, that's reversing what enabled the legislation that enabled Honzik to be extradited to Austria. And I see that as a positive development.
Yes. Okay. That you're okay now. You're sounding much better now. All right. You know, I noticed that the countries of the European Union that had these laws against Holocaust denial, those who do not have it are these pig countries, Greece, Italy, Ireland, and Spain, except for Portugal. Portugal does have it. Isn't that interesting?
And Sweden. Sweden doesn't have it either.
Yeah, well, I think they're, okay. Is Sweden in the European Union? Yeah, that's right. Sweden is not in this list. You're correct.
Well, Ramin, this is where Radio Islam still functions. Otherwise, he'd be out of action.
Yes. Okay. So, it seems to me that the tactic of these Well, you know what I'd really like to ask you in the time that we have left, so I don't forget it, is are you planning to run for an office? And what are you planning to do, Frederick?
When I had Sir John Walsh represent me for this day hearing, he indicated that anyone who is bankrupted cannot stand for office, parliamentary office. And bankruptcies usually last for 3 years plus. And so he indicated to the judge that he should look at the material which would enable us to meet the bankruptcy or to eliminate the bankruptcy action by paying the fine. In other words, it wasn't that I wasn't going to pay the court costs. But I now have the – I don't know whether I sent you the link, but I will after, where the solicitor states quite clearly that he wanted to bankrupt last year.
Yes, quite clear. Mm-hmm. Tell us.
Yeah, they wanted to bankrupt me, and therefore they didn't want the money. It was bankrupting me.
Oh yeah, there's a video at this link, and they said we're able to jail Tobin. We're about to bankrupt Tobin. He was giving a speech at his Jewish organization.
And he was one of the members of Parliament trying to stand for Parliament as a Labour Party candidate. Now, at that clip, 17:40, so 17 minutes, 40 seconds into it, and that indicated to me that, you know, they're trying, and what they said at the beginning, 96, they have to stop me from functioning. And if you can't send them to prison, if prison doesn't help, then next thing is bankrupting someone. And it goes on and on. And then if all this doesn't help, then, of course, the hit team from Mossad comes in. And that's obvious. But these things I don't expect to happen now because it's too wide. But the coming back to the Senate, standing for the Senate, we have a new member of Parliament in the federal Parliament, Josh Frydenberg, who, when Labour Party and union member questioned 9/11, and all he did was ask me, he said we should look at 9/11 again because technically it's not possible what happened according to the official theory. Mm-hmm. Very much what the Holocaust people are saying about the gassings. Technically it's not possible, it's not feasible.
That's
criminalized. So now I can see in America what they're going to do. They will then shut this off through legal means. It will be upsetting. For example, did you know that anyone who travels to America in a working visa, say in publicity or whatever sphere, they have to sign a contract or have to sign a piece of paper stating they will not say anything critical of America?
Oh.
And yes, and that's massive. That's a massive censorship for anyone coming in. Journalists, anything coming in.
You mean people who come in on a working visa?
They
are foreigners?
In the media, yes, they must sign a piece of paper that states they will not make any critical comments about the American society. It's massive. Of course, we had the similar thing where if you travel to America, you must, if you've been guilty of moral turpitude, which is having damaged property or persons, then you cannot get into the country. And I got back into America, even though I had this prison sentence, I have no criminal record. Because in America, this is not a criminal matter. It's treated as defamation, what we're doing. And that's why we still have free expression. And in England, the same. The concepts or the opinions, an expression of opinions, is not yet criminalized, although they're doing this by splitting this free expression into free speech and hate speech. And hate speech is then, that's the on the coattail they ride on into criminalizing what you're saying. So this Frydenberg, let me just say this Frydenberg, he's in Parliament, in his opening speech, he said it's an outrage that anyone questions 9/11. Well, of course it's not an outrage. He did this in Parliament. And I thought, well, if he can do that, maybe I should go into Parliament and express my viewpoint on the Holocaust, because that is free expression put totally to the test.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been waiting, and I'm still waiting, for the 9/11 truth people, who are quite numerous, actually, to notice that what they're fighting is the very same thing that the Holocaust truth movement is fighting. But they don't seem to want to make that connection. They'd rather stay away from it. But it is the same thing. I mean, you can't help but notice the similarity there, right?
At both, and you know, both lead to a downfall of a political system. The
That's
Holocaust
right.
brings down Israel, and the 9/11 brings down America.
But you
That's
see, the 9/11 is full of liberals who are very much afraid of bringing down the Holocaust per se, because they think it will somehow rehabilitate National Socialism.
Well, the point is, we are now in the 1930s again with the financial crises, the way it is. And only one person in the 1930s dared do it with his party, and that was Adolf Hitler. And forget the Holocaust and all that stuff. But on the 21st of April 1933, he was the first one who banned kosher slaughter, therefore attacking one of the prime pillars of the Jewish religion. And this has not been forgotten, has not been forgiven. Hence, the Holocaust is there to intimidate the Germans, because they dared be civilized, they dared be cultural, they dared fight for truth, honor, and justice. And all those liberating forces, look at the philosophy of the German philosophers. Hegel's dialectic is a life-giving dialectic where opposites come together and bring a new synthesis, while the Marxist Talmudic dialectic is a death dialectic. It's win-lose, which is primitive.
Very good. You know, you really do need a platform to say these things, Frederick. You do. Do you think you would have a chance of being elected?
I don't know. I don't know whether I have the energy to do this.
I know. I mean, you could just sort of put it out there and let people vote for you. You'd have to actually run around and campaign.
I think, if it minimum effort, maximum effect would guide me if anything did happen. But nowadays you need a lot of money to overcome the propaganda machine of the establishment. You remember we had only one nationalist group that nearly made it. Well, we had Pauline Hanson, and she was criminalized, put in jail, but of course everything was quashed later on. Still, the One Nation mindset is a nationalist mindset, but both the Liberal and Labour's in Australia, they're both internationalists, and Australia's being sold. Most of the industry is overseas. And, well, in fact, the nation, Australia, and its various states have a business number. We're corporatized, head office in Washington. We have admiralty law and common law running parallel and essentially privatizing everything, and then it's up for grabs. Look what they said about Greece's debt. They said immediately, why don't you sell some of your islands? In other words, the nation state. And we have this British politician in the European Parliament. What's his name? I forget his name, but he's a wonderful fellow.
Oh, that Farage guy?
Yeah, Farage, yes. Because he states it quite clearly. He says the Euro people hate the word national. They want everyone to be the same. And what more delightful thing for people to be free is to be different, to have different nationalities, different ethnic groups, and so on. This is what is a delightful thing. But we're killing this through what's happening today, development. I think the South American Adrian Sabucci Is that how you pronounce it?
That's how I pronounce it. Well, I thought I was watching, but I guess I'm not. So thank you so much, Frederick.
That's it.
On. That's it. We have to say goodnight. Goodbye.
Roger then. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at Reason Radio Network.